Okay, so this is a general talk about patents, where I want to try to make some of the complications of patents more comprehensible by explaining the motivations of the people involved. And I think there are many complicated aspects of patents, but when you realize what people are trying to do, then it becomes more obvious how the patent system works, why it works the way that it does. I have two parts to this. First part is just very general, not about cryptography, giving some historical examples of patents. And the second part will be specifically about some cryptographic patents, but nothing about post-quantum patents. All right, I've also been told that this talk has been advertised as an anti-patent talk, but I want to make clear that these examples, I'm just going to be telling you the facts of what happened, and if that makes patents look bad, then, well, that's not my fault at all. So, let me jump in with the origin of the word patent. This comes from declarations from British kings and British queens. The British monarchy, they were issuing letters, declarations. There were two types of letters. One type is letters close, and this means declarations that were not open to the public. And then letters patent, those are declarations that were open to the public. The Latin word patent is something laying open. So people, it would be a declaration that could be posted somewhere, and the public would be able to see it. And that's important for, well, telling people about monopolies, which the example on this slide is an example of a monopoly issued by Queen Elizabeth I in 1576. So this was a public declaration, a letter patent, which was saying that two people, Ralph Bowes and Thomas Bedingfeld, had a monopoly on something. I'll tell you the something in a moment. And what this monopoly is saying is this was for selling something, and this was saying that only Bowes and Bedingfeld were allowed to sell that. Nobody else was allowed to do that unless they had permission from Bowes and Bedingfeld. So Bowes and Bedingfeld could charge any price they wanted for this item. Anything, of course, that people were willing to pay. So they could set the price to be as high as people were willing to pay, which is different from the normal situation. Is somebody else starts manufacturing it for a lower cost, closer to the manufacturing cost. And because of that competition, people buy things for prices that are close to the manufacturing costs. But when there's a monopoly, nobody is allowed to compete. So only Bowes and Bedingfeld were allowed to sell this item. Other people could ask them for permission, ask them for licenses, and they could say, okay, you have to pay us this amount for licenses. And so they would make as much money as they could possibly get out of people, not just the manufacturing costs. What were they having a monopoly on? Well, the answer is playing cards. Nobody other than Bowes and Bedingfeld was allowed to sell playing cards in England. And this was important because people like card games. And I mean, now, of course, we play card games online with multi-party computation or a trusted third party, but in the 1500s, people needed playing cards to play card games. And so this was a very important monopoly, and they used this to make a lot of money. And then Queen Elizabeth kept renewing the monopoly, 1578, 1588. I think Bedingfeld died in 1588. And then the monopoly was just given to Bowes, and then Bowes died in 1598, and Elizabeth extended the monopoly for 21 more years and issued a public declaration that now the monopoly is owned by Edward Darcy in consideration of his long and acceptable services to the crown, so to the queen. So to summarize the Darcy versus Queen, trade here. Darcy was providing services to the Queen, and the Queen was giving Darcy a monopoly, which was worth a lot of money. And Darcy used that to make a lot of money. Okay, so simple trade. The queen had the power to do this, and Darcy was serving the queen. The queen was providing a gift. This was just one example of a monopoly issued by Queen Elizabeth. For example, in 1585, she provided Thomas Wilkes a monopoly on the salt industry. Now, this was in exchange for, Wilkes was a diplomat, which means that he was arranging wars in other countries. So he was famous for, he went to, well, Germany was a complicated political concept at that point, but he went to a ruler, Frederick III from Zimmern in the House of Wittelsbach, and convinced this prince to take his army to help the Huguenots in France against Queen Catherine in France. There was a big rivalry between England and France in the 1500s. Well, not just the 1500s, but England was very happy to cause problems for France. And so this diplomat caused an invasion and actually came along with the army to help invade France. And France lost some territory and lost some political power. So England was very happy with this. And Elizabeth gave this diplomat a monopoly on salt. And so he could set the price of salt to anything he wanted and license people. They would have to pay whatever he asked for manufacturing salt. And there were many, many more examples. Historian David Hume published a book in 1778 listing more of Queen Elizabeth's monopolies. These are all things that Queen Elizabeth issued a monopoly on. And then at the end, he comments on salt in particular. He says, "These monopolists were so exorbitant in their demands that in some places they raised the price of salt from 16 pence a bushel to 14 or 15 shillings," which I should maybe translate from British. So a shilling is 12 pence. So 14, 15 shillings, that's 180 pence, which is much more than 16 pence. Now, you might not think this is very much money when you think a pence, that's like a penny, so 180 pennies. For a bushel of salt, which is more than 30 liters of salt, which sounds like a lot of salt. But I should emphasize two things. First, in the 1500s, people did not have, well, not just multi-party computation, but in the 1500s, people did not have refrigerators or a stable supply chain. And so food preservation was very important, and people did not have fancy preservatives. Salt was the main food preservative. People were using a lot of salt to stay alive and preserve food. And okay, so a bushel of salt was much less than a lifetime supply of salt. And also for 180 pennies, well, it's important to keep in mind, if I understand United States news correctly, the 1500s was shortly before Joe Biden took office. And then his response to the second bubonic plague was causing a lot of inflation, which means that the purchasing power of a penny is much less today than it was back in 1585. In all seriousness, a skilled carpenter working for a month in 1585 would maybe make 15 shillings. So this was a lot of money for a bushel of salt. And there were many other monopolies, and people had to pay high prices for lots of things, not just salt. Not everything had a monopoly. For example, in 1589, William Lee invented a stocking frame knitting machine. There are legends about why. One legend says that his girlfriend or his wife was spending a lot of time knitting by hand, and, well, he wanted to save time. And so he invented what is apparently a very important historically type of knitting machine, stocking frame knitting machine. And he came to Queen Elizabeth. And Queen Elizabeth said, no, no patent for you. You do not have a monopoly on these knitting machines. Now, there are different stories for why Elizabeth did not provide a monopoly. One story says that she thought the quality of the knitting was not good. And so if she's thinking, you know, what is this machine doing for me? Answer is not much. So why should she give a patent? And then another story says that she thought the knitting was amazing and she was worried about destroying the hand knitting industry, which I guess means that all of the hand knitters would no longer be able to afford salt or anything else they needed. I'm skeptical of this second story, but in any case, it's clear that she did not grant a patent. It's also clear that William Lee continued working on his knitting machines, and it's clear that the King of France, King Henry IV, agreed to give him a patent monopoly on his knitting machines, and so he moved to France in 1608. All right, so this monopoly was not granted in England, but, well, remember the England versus France rivalry. He did get a patent in France. Let me come back to playing cards. There was a famous court case in 1602 called the Case of Monopolies, where Darcy, remember, Darcy had a patent on playing cards. He had a monopoly. He was the only person allowed to sell playing cards. And, well, some other manufacturer started, without permission, manufacturing playing cards and selling those playing cards. And Darcy took that manufacturer to court, common law court. And, well, he had some lawyers, including a famous lawyer, Edward Coke. Edward Coke published, he was a lawyer and a judge, and published books about the law, including reports on many court cases. And this is the best information we have about English law at that time. And then what did this report say was the argument for Darcy? Well, here's what it said. This is something else I think I should try to translate from British. This said, playing cards are not necessary for people. Playing cards are entertainment. Playing cards are a use of time. Playing cards are wasting your inheritance, wasting the money that you got from your parents. They're wasting your life. Your servants are not doing their jobs because they are busy playing card games. Card games are addictive, and addiction is the source of suffering and eternal damnation. And so the Queen has the power and the duty to stop this abuse. She can regulate the use of playing cards. And, well, the arguments continued like this, saying there's actually a law that says the king and queen can regulate matters of recreation and pleasure in any way they want. Because of the great abuse of playing cards, the queen has the power to outlaw playing cards. She can ban playing cards if she wants. And because she can outlaw them, she also can allow them but regulate them any way she wants. Nobody can complain about that. And this is an important law, this law that says the king and queen have control over recreation and pleasure, is because most people will overdose on entertainment. Entertainment is clickbait. Playing cards are social media. Okay, maybe I'm being a little loose with the translation here, but this law is a well-established law that has been applied many times. For example, you are not allowed, of course, to make a park on your own property for your recreation unless you have permission from the king. Or another example of how well this is established, the king provided a patent which was giving one person the authority over all the wild swans between London Bridge and Oxford. I'm not sure whether the Wild Swans were agreeing with this and whether nobody else was being entertained by the Wild Swans, but in any case, that's what the report says was argued in the court case. Now, the other side, of course, made its own arguments, and the judges invalidated the patent. The judges said, look, that's nice about entertainment being bad, but this, let's look at what this patent is actually doing. The patent is a monopoly, and that is illegal. And here's why. They gave several reasons, but the critical one is a monopoly is saying only one person can sell this object, playing cards. Anybody else who wants to sell playing cards, they are damaged. But also, society is damaged because the point of the monopoly is to make money for the patent holder. Once there's a monopoly, the patent holder is not using it to benefit the public. The patent holder is using it to make money for his private benefit. So, the patent monopoly was invalidated. This other manufacturer of playing cards was able to continue without giving all his money to Darcy. But in England at that point, just because judges in the common law court said something is bad, monopolies are bad, that doesn't mean that monopolies disappeared. There were multiple courts, the Star Chamber, for example. There was a big power battle between Parliament and the king, and it wasn't until 40, 50 years later that the king was executed and the Parliament took more control. But anyway, The point is that after Queen Elizabeth, the next king, King James I, was issuing more patents. For example, in 1617, King James provided someone named Montpensier a monopoly on the hotel industry. And this was because, well, Montpensier's sister-in-law was the half-sister of King James' favorite lover. Okay, so family connections, and King James gave a monopoly to Montpensier. And what this monopoly said was, everybody who wants to run a hotel needs a license from Montpensier. And, okay, whatever they pay for the license, that's chosen by Montpensier, 80% of that has to go to the king, 20% goes to Montpensier. So, of course, Montpensier chooses the prices as high as people are possibly willing to pay. And then Montpensier decided that was not enough money. So he started extorting hotels and bars. For example, Montpensier sent an agent to a bar, and the agent was drinking at the bar. And at the end of the night, the agent said, oh, I'm drunk, I won't be able to go home. Bar owner, can you let me sleep here? I'll pay you for if you have a bed. And the bar owner said, yeah, I do have a bed, sleep well. The next morning, the agent woke up, said, ah, that was nice, and went to the bar owner and said, thank you for providing me a bed in exchange for money. This means that you are running a hotel. And I am an agent of Montpensier, so you are going to jail for running an illegal hotel, unless you pay us lots of money. And this happened many, many times, and there were more mechanisms of Montpensier's bribes. There were enough complaints that by 1621, Parliament started investigating the extortion by Montpensier. And the complaints were clear, the evidence was clear. Montpensier went to France. No extradition agreements between France and England at that point. Parliament sentenced Montpensier to life in prison, declared him an outrageous criminal. But Prince Charles said, that's too much. Montpensier, you can come back, you can retire here, give some money back, but you can live comfortably at your home in England. Again, power battles between the king and Parliament. Okay, a few days after Montpensier left the country, there was a proposed law in Parliament to say monopolies are illegal. This was written by the same Edward Coke who had lost the court case for Darcy. A representative of the king, George Calvert, the Secretary of State, said, can we at least have an exception for new inventions? Of course, what was happening with Montesson and other monopolists was very, very unpopular. But, well, the king still wanted some power to issue some monopolies. And remember what happened with the knitting machine. This was kind of embarrassing. I mean, you know, after William Lee went to France, since then, I mean, 400 years, France has been a world leader in fashion. And so, I mean, England was realizing, yeah, this is a problem. We want to attract inventors to England, maybe get some of those French inventors to England. So can we please have this exception? And then, okay, the law passed in 1623, the Statute of Monopolies, where Section 1 says all monopolies are invalid. But Section 6 has an exception, which says for inventions, new inventions, the king is allowed to grant a monopoly up to 14 years to the true inventor, the first inventor, if this does not raise prices and does not damage the market. So this starts sounding like how we think about patents today, but let's think about these different conditions of not raising prices and having the first inventor allowed to have a patent. Suppose you have the second inventor being a year later, then that means there's 13 years of the monopoly increasing prices. So the only way for this exception to make sense is if the second inventor is, well, 14 years or more after the first inventor, then it won't raise prices to have the first inventor having a monopoly. All right, so this, they were probably looking at examples like glass manufacturing in Venice to come up with this 14 years as a reasonable time, and not like the playing cards for, I mean, cards were invented much earlier, but, I mean, many monopolies were granted for many more years. And the 14, unfortunately, there's no records, but they must have been looking at examples of inventions to think 14 is a reasonable time for a patent on a new invention. All right. Today we have patent law where I'll give two examples of this, one being the U.S., where in the U.S. Constitution from the late 1700s, the U.S. legislature, Congress, has the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by providing monopolies on writings and discoveries to the authors and inventors for limited times. Now, soon after this, Congress did pass a patent law, and there have been various changes to that. The current patent law says, anybody who invents or discovers any new and useful process or machine or an improvement, a new improvement over a previous process or machine, can obtain a patent, unless the invention was already for sale or described in a publication before the patent, or it was obvious from what was published before. All right, so that's current patent law. And comparing that to the Constitution, well, something has been lost here. And remember, the idea in the Statute of Monopolies, you're not supposed to raise prices. And this is something where these monopolies, of course, raise prices. That's the whole point. The only way they would not raise prices is if you have an invention which would not have happened for the period of the patent. And so in the Statute of Monopolies, there was a requirement, don't raise prices. In the Constitution, there's a requirement to promote progress. In the patent law, it just says if you have a new invention, something that was not already obvious, you can have a patent. So what happened to promoting progress? What happened to not raising prices? Well, sometimes the courts in the US say, actually, this does put a limit on patent law. For example, in the US, you are not allowed to patent an abstract idea, a mathematical formula, a law of nature. And these categories are justified by the courts because they say patents on mathematical formulas would not promote progress. But if you're outside those categories, is a cryptographic system a mathematical formula? Well, maybe. If you're not in those categories, then you cannot go to court and say, this patent is damaging progress. It's only these categories where you can say, in those categories, people cannot have patents. Okay, the basic motivations now for the U.S. are, well, there's a patent office, and every patent that it grants, it gets money for the patent. There's also an application fee to apply for a patent, but they get more money if they grant more patents. So the patent office motivations are clear. The patent holders are, as always, trying to make money. And then the only people suffering are the public, and the only constraints on this are what's in the law and what the courts apply to limit this. Another example of current patent law in Europe, there's a European Patent Convention, and this is something that many European countries have signed. And that says that European patents shall be granted for any invention in any field of technology if it's new and has an inventive step, basically means not obvious, and is maybe useful. And again, what happened to the idea of this should not raise prices, which was the original objection to patents? Well, there are a few exceptions here. The European Patent Convention says no patents on mathematical formulas or on computer programs. So it's not clear how cryptographic patents get around this, but well, anyway, there are some exceptions, with the boundaries maybe not being clear. There's no general requirement saying that European patents have to promote progress. And of course, European patent offices, the more patents they give, the more money they make. And while people applying for patents, the more patents they get, the more money they make. So the motivation's very simple trade. The only people suffering are the general public. If you read articles from people, scholars who are studying the patent system and saying, oh, look at how important patents are, or if you read advertising from patent offices around the world of why patents are supposed to be good, they will say the following. Here's they pick an example of an invention, some X in this slide, and they say, this invention was patented, which means that we gave somebody a monopoly on, they're the only people who can sell X for, say, 20 years. And that is something which is in exchange for they have to publish it. I mean, the patent has to say publicly what is patented, and that includes saying, oh, here's the details of your invention that you are having a monopoly on. Everybody gets to see that invention, and so you cannot keep it secret and have the monopoly. And then after the monopoly expires, then other people can use it. All right, second step in the advertising is to say that this invention is something that people are using and that is valuable for people, for society, to be using this invention. And then the third step in the argument is saying, well, if it's patented and it's valuable, then that means the patent is valuable. Where the idea is supposed to be that, well, if you didn't have the patent, then you would not have X deployed, but somehow that's missing from the advertising. The advertising never says, would this invention have been published without the patent? And the advertising never says, would we actually have more deployment and more value to society from this invention without the patent. This is something which is sometimes challenged, this advertising. For example, I also quoted this a little bit in when I was giving some slides on patents at the workshop. Mark Lemley has a paper on the myth of the sole inventor. And he says the idea of patent law is that experts are having trouble solving some problem, and there's some genius who figures out how to solve that problem. But that won't happen unless the genius is given the incentive of making money from a monopoly. But then he says that this whole idea, this model of technological progress, is a myth. There are surveys of hundreds of significant new technologies where almost all of them were invented at the same time by two or more teams working independently. The exceptions tend to be technologies where one team invents it and they're public about it so quickly that nobody else bothers looking at it. But that doesn't mean that it would have been nobody else inventing it. It just means that, well, nobody else, I mean, one person happened to be very fast, but somebody else would have come along maybe a year later if that first person did not invent it. So in science, of course, we give credit to the first person publishing something. But if people are thinking, oh, I published this first and therefore nobody else would have figured this out, that's not justified. And there are many, many counterexamples. And in fact, again, almost all new technologies are counterexamples demonstrated by the record. All right, so this brings me to cryptography, where I want to look at some big examples of cryptographic patents and see what happened with the discoveries of those. And again, I'm going to focus on examples here, and again, if this sounds like it's patents are a very bad idea, well, that's not my perspective, it's just the facts. So, let's start with public key cryptography, which was first invented, publicly anyway, by Ralph Merkle. In summer 1975, he submitted a paper which described a public key crypto system, the Merkle puzzles. This paper was called Secure Communications Over Insecure Channels. Of course, symmetric cryptography, if you've already exchanged a key, then if you have a secret key using a secure channel, then you can use an insecure channel later. But the idea of this paper was with no secret communication, you can still do secure communication. With no original secure channel, you can use your insecure channel to set up secure communication. And then, independently of Merkle, Diffie and Hellman, in December 1975, sent around a paper to lots of people called Multi-User Cryptographic Techniques. And now this, people get confused sometimes because public key cryptography is typically credited to a subsequent paper from Diffie and Hellman, New Directions in Cryptography. But the whole idea of public key cryptography is clear in this paper, Multi-User Cryptographic Techniques. And they gave various examples of proposed public key crypto systems, like what's called the permuted circuits system. Quote from Diffie is, "We wrote the paper in December 1975 and sent preprints around immediately." So lots of people saw this. Merkle saw it and then contacted Diffie and Hellman. Merkle was a student at the time. And Diffie was a student of Hellman. Merkle contacted them and said, "Hey, I have this paper. I had the same idea. Different examples, but both Merkle and Diffie-Hellman had the basic idea of public key cryptography." And then, well, lots of people were looking for public key crypto systems. Once you see the idea and some example, then you're thinking, where can I find more examples? Diffie, in 1988 history of this, he says that at the time, in 1975, he was considering various suggestions for one-way functions that, well, first just, okay, are these one way? And then can you use those to build a public key crypto system? For example, John Gill at Stanford suggested exponentiation. Diffie and Hellman were asking around Stanford, do people know examples of these functions? And John Gill said, well, modular exponentiation, that's a good example, maybe. And then Diffie looked at a book which was talking about NP completeness and said, ooh, knapsacks, that sounds like a good way to produce a public key crypto system. And then Knuth at Stanford said, oh, how about multiplying big prime numbers? That's one way. Seems like what's one way anyway. And then again, this is just what was happening at Stanford, and other people like RSA or McLeese, hearing about public key cryptography, they also looked for examples and found various examples. One of the examples, of course, is exponential key exchange, Diffie-Hellman key exchange, G to the A, G to the B, G to the AB. And this is something that, well, after Gill's suggestion and the Diffie-Hellman discussions, Diffie says that one morning in May 1976, Hellman just wrote down exponential key exchange. And then Diffie and Hellman added it to their upcoming presentation at the National Computer Conference and to their paper, their new paper that they were working on, New Directions in Cryptography, which they sent to IEEE Transactions on Information Theory. And they distributed the preprint to lots of people. And yeah, this National Computer Conference, June 1976, they presented exponential key exchange, and they went to another conference in Sweden and presented it there. So all of this, of course, was just academics distributing their ideas, and lots of people saw these ideas in 1975, 1976. Stephen Levy wrote a book about crypto and interviewed everybody and said that in 1976, thoughts about patents were the furthest thing from the minds of Diffie and Hellman. In contrast to the government, NSA and NIST, not providing all the details of the data encryption standard, they were creating a fully open alternative to conventional cryptography itself. Okay, Ralph Merkel was just doing a homework assignment for a project for a class. I mean, people have different levels of hype for what they're working on. The point is, none of them were thinking about patents until, well, there was lots of positive feedback about public key cryptography and exponential key exchange. And then Stanford University said, you know, we can make money on this. So they filed a patent application. They said, all right, here's a patent. One claim is on the general idea of public key cryptography. One claim is on exponential key exchange in particular. Of course, if you have a monopoly on public key cryptography, then you also have a monopoly on exponential key exchange. But people writing patent applications like to have many of these layers because sometimes courts say, oh, your first claim, your first monopoly is too broad for some reason, like there was somebody else who came up with that idea, but you can still have the specific exponential key exchange patent. And so patent applications claim multiple things at multiple levels. And that's what Stanford University did. But wait a minute, the patent monopoly is supposed to be in exchange for publication. They already published. So, what's going on here? Well, they explained the 1975 publication as follows. They said that that paper does not present a demonstration system of public key cryptography or a proof that public key cryptography exists. But this is just not true. I mean, okay, we don't have a proof, but that paper, the 1975 paper, presented some examples, some demonstrations of public key cryptography, like the permuted circuits system. Maybe not all of them are secure, but it was still demonstrating the invention. And I mean, exponential key exchange is not secure once you have a quantum computer. So, I mean, for purposes of patent law, it's completely clear that the 1975 paper was presenting the idea of public key cryptography and was giving examples of that. And that should have meant that the 1977 patent should not have been granted. But, well, the lawyers lied about it and said there's no demonstration, no example in that paper. What about the 1976 publication of Exponential Key Exchange? Well, what they said was they cited this paper in their list, in their bibliography for the patent. They said this paper was published in IEEE Transactions on Information Theory in November 1976. And that's all they said about the publication. They did not say, oh, actually, the paper was already distributed in May, June 1976. There was already a talk at two conferences in June 1976. They just forgot to mention that. And so the patent office reading this would say, oh, it was published in November 1976, not June. Now, this is important, and here's why. Even though this is before the patent application, in the United States, you are allowed to publish something and then wait a year and then file a patent application. It depends on the country whether this is allowed. Europe, it's generally not allowed. I mean, again, the patent is supposed to be you get a monopoly on a new invention in exchange for we're making it public. If you've already made it public, sorry, too late. No patent. But in the U.S., you can have a patent up to a year. So November 1976 to September 1977, that's less than a year. June 1976 to September 1977, that's more than a year. So two clear reasons that the public key cryptography patent and the exponential key exchange patent, those should not have been granted. But the lawyers lied about this. And, I mean, of course, Stanford was also motivated by making money. It's very simple why people want patents. This patent was granted. Claim 1 of the patent was on public key cryptography, and Claim 6 was Diffie-Hellman key exchange, exponential key exchange. And then the company that Stanford started to license the patent, they claimed that any method of using public key cryptography was covered by this patent and by various follow-up patents on more types of public key cryptography. And people were scared for many years to distribute software which was using public key cryptography. There was, in 1994, a court case which said this patent is invalid, and there were filings in the court case. Court cases go for a long time, and there's evidence being filed, and the links I have on the slide here are to evidence of the Diffie-Hellman paper being distributed in June 1976 to various people. It was clearly being freely distributed. It was not something where people were required to keep it secret. And this meant the patent was invalid. Well, after a few years of litigation, the case was settled in 1997, a few months before the patent expired. Not very helpful for people thinking of deploying public key cryptography if there's a court case after, well, 17 years after the patent application is filed. Starting in 1997, the patent expired. People were able to deploy Diffie-Hellman. How about RSA? Well, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman, of course, also academics. They were assistant professors at MIT at the time. And they wrote a technical report, which they were saying, here's a crypto system, public key crypto system. And then MIT, this was the MIT Laboratory of Computer Science. Their technical reports are things that the MIT will send those to anybody who asks for them. And then RSA also discussed this crypto system with Martin Gardner, who had a regular column in Scientific American. And, well, August 1977, he had a column all about this exciting new crypto system. All right. At the same time, Michael Rabin, Turing Award winner, smart guy, was also looking at public key cryptography and thinking, I have some examples of this. And in 1978, he had a paper about public key signatures. And in that paper, he says, a public key system employing large prime numbers was discovered by Rabin and independently by Rivest, Edelman, and Shamir. In 1979, Rabin wrote a technical report saying what he had done, which it has actually some interesting advantages, but same basic idea, exponentiation modulo PQ, where P and Q are your secret primes. So this is something else that was discovered by at least two groups at the same time, and maybe more who just never mentioned it, more who would have discovered it if RSA and Rabin had not. In any case, it's clear that these two discovered it at the same time. And then, remember, Knuth was also mentioning P and Q mapping to P times Q as a one-way function. And probably if nobody else had thought about this RSA system, Knuth would have said it. This column in Scientific American from Martin Gardner said, anybody who sends an envelope to Rivest with 35 cents of postage, things were cheaper at that point, can have a copy of this report. And Rivest sent out thousands of copies of the report. People were very, very interested in the RSA system. Then, according to Simpson Garfinkel's book on PGP, the head of the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science said, ooh, we can make money for this great idea of RSA. People are very interested in it, so let's patent it. At least let's try. And so in December 1977, MIT, less than a year after publication, MIT filed a patent application on RSA. And Garfinkel's book says, well, again, foreign countries, different rules, not allowed to come later with a patent application. It's already published. But in the U.S., you can publish first, and then when people are excited about it, you can then file a patent application. This is something which was again granted as a patent by the U.S. Patent Office. So RSA made a lot of money, and the Patent Office made a little money. Garfinkel says that this was used, for example, to slow down distribution of PGP. Jim Bidzos, who was the head of the RSA company, he learned about people distributing PGP, this illegal encryption software, and he sent letters saying, stop distributing PGP. Big internet companies at that time, CompuServe, America Online, they had to stop distributing PGP. He sent letters to universities saying, do not provide PGP to your students. The Electronic Frontier Foundation took PGP software down. And this only stopped in 2000 when the patent expired. And there was really, I mean, there were, so the RSA company was looking ahead. They were trying to encourage certain uses of RSA under their control in ways that they could make money and that they would continue making money. But it was much more limited than RSA deployment after 2000. The patents that I've been talking about, these really basic patents on public key cryptography, Diffie-Hellman, RSA, it is completely clear these were published by academics who were not thinking about patents until administrators came along later and said, ooh, we can make money, let's patent this. And obviously, there was enough incentive for this publication. You get credit. I mean, assistant professors who are thinking, ooh, this is a nice idea, and then if we publish this, we get credit. Of course, that's enough motivation to publish. And then, well, after that, the administrators said, let's make money. Also, each of the examples I've given, there were either two independent discoveries or it's such a simple thing with multiple people involved that it's easy to see how there would have been independent discoveries. In the case of public key cryptography, it's clearly documented that there were two teams, well, Merkel and DH, they both discovered public key cryptography. RSA and Rabin both discovered the RSA system. Diffie-Hellman, okay, maybe we don't have evidence of somebody else discovering that, but it seems very likely that if they had not found it, then somebody else in 1977, 1978 would have found it. Let me give some more patent examples. Schnorr. This is something where there were many signature systems. El-Gamal started with a group-based signature system, different from the RSA signature system. And then there were many variations on this. And one of those variations was from Klaus Schnorr, who, of course, was also a professor being paid to publish things. And, well, this particular system, I like this. As group-based signature systems, this is really a very nice one. One way to see that it's nice is that if you're using multiplicative groups, FP star, then Schnorr's signatures are shorter than previous signatures. If you're using elliptic curves, okay, the size is the same, but it's still, you can see that it's more streamlined than previous proposals. There are many variations, and this is making some good choices and putting them together into one good signature system. Well, he filed a patent application on that. How long would it have taken for other people to find it? Unclear. But there were various proposals in mid-80s, 85, 86, 87, etc., and probably by 91 or so, other people would have found this. It's a small difference from previous things. It is nice. I like the Schnorr system, but okay. In any case, he said, I'm filing a patent application on this. It's, even if nobody else found it, it's, again, completely clear that as a professor, he would have published it to get credit without the patent incentive. But he also wanted to make money. And then he received a patent, for example, in the U.S., and then that was in 91, and then 92 got a European patent, etc. All filed. You can file in one country, and then you can file in other countries saying, look, I already filed it in the U.S., and that's my priority date, and so you're allowed to file in other countries after your first patent application for the same thing. Public Key Partners, the Diffie-Hellman licensing organization, they bought this patent from Schnorr. And so, okay, Schnorr made some money, and then Public Key Partners wanted to make money. And, well, until 2008, basically people stayed away from the Schnorr system because, well, the Schnorr patent was, you could pay money for this or do something which is a little less streamlined, but is perfectly reasonable signature system that's not the Schnorr system. And again, Schnorr, it's clear from his role as a professor, he would have published this even without the patent. And again, I would think maybe 90, 91, 92, somebody else would have discovered it because lots of people were trying different signature systems at that time. One of the groups trying different signature systems and not coming up with such a nice one, but still okay, was, well, publicly NIST, which in 1991 said, here's an official government publication. The U.S. government has notices in the Federal Register, which was saying, here's a proposed standard for a digital signature algorithm. Now, people got suspicious because NIST has, in 1991, not a lot of cryptographic expertise, whereas they do have a history of collaborating with another organization that does have cryptographic expertise, but maybe not your best interests at heart. So Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility filed a request, FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, saying, please provide the documents of how you came up with this signature standard. Now, this FOIA is a law which says that government agencies have to be transparent with certain limitations. And, well, NIST said, no, we're not providing this information. CPSR, this Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, said, okay, please reconsider. NIST said, no. And then CPSR went to court. And, well, NIST has no excuse for hiding the information. So after a few months of court proceedings, there was a response saying, okay, we have 142 pages of documents from NIST and more than 1,000 pages from the National Security Agency, NSA. And then after more litigation, NIST actually provided the documents, which made completely clear that this was an NSA design, not a NIST design. I mean, already from seeing there's 1,000 pages from NSA, that makes clear that, I mean, that's 1,000 pages that NIST had for of NSA information about this. Who knows how much more was secret inside NSA. Anyway, so this was an NSA algorithm. And let me look back at what happened before this became public. NIST filed a patent application in July 1991, before they said, hey, this is a public proposal. They filed a patent application saying that DSA was invented by David Kravitz from the National Security Agency. And then, okay, after everybody understood this was actually from NSA, NIST then filed secret patent applications in many more countries. Eventually, patent applications become public unless there's a secrecy order. NSA has an interesting ability to say the patent office is not allowed to make this patent application public. In June 1993, NIST said, okay, we have this patent application and we are going to transfer the patent to public key partners unless within 60 days you can convince us that this is illegal. Now, you might be wondering, why is the government filing a patent in the first place on something? I mean, a government agency, they have their rules, their procedures for what they're doing. If they're inventing something because of that, they don't need the motivation of a patent monopoly. I mean, I don't think an agency is even allowed to make extra money from patents. So why was there this NIST NSA patent on DSA? Well, the answer, all of these patent monopolies, the point is control. You can make money, that's the traditional way to use a patent, but you can also use patents to limit how people are using something. You can tell people don't use this at all. And well, NSA was trying many things to stop people from using cryptography. So filing a patent, well, I mean, maybe it's something they could find useful. For example, giving the patent to a company that would not allow people to use it. And then they received the patent in July 1993. And then what happened next? Well, NIST said that the purpose of having a patent and giving it to this patent company, that the purpose was to minimize royalties, which is very strange because they admitted that this company would be collecting royalties, collecting money, license fees, as much as they wanted on the digital signature standard, DSA, for the remainder of the 17-year lifetime of the patent. At that point, patents were lasting 17 years after they were granted. Now, patents last 20 years after the application. Okay, how is this minimizing royalties? Well, what NIST said was, first of all, PKP, Public Key Partners, has the Schnorr patent, which is not going to expire until 2008. So, why not give them another patent which expires in 2010? You can't use it anyway. Except, wait a minute, Schnorr and DSA are different algorithms. There were many different signature algorithms. The Schnorr one is nice, but DSA is okay. And why does the Schnorr patent justify giving DSA to public key partners? Well, NIST said that transferring will avoid litigation because Public Key Partners was threatening lawsuits because they wanted money, and if people don't pay them, then they say we'll take you to court. And NIST said they had an agreement with Public Key Partners, PKP's royalty rates, what they would charge for using DSA was no more than 2.5% for hardware or 5% for software. Now, that actually starts sounding reasonable. That's something which, I mean, depending, if this happens all the time, if you have software with many different patented algorithms, then okay, it's maybe 5% for each one. That's a big problem. But 5%, if it's just for one thing, maybe you can afford that. And if it's free software, 5% of zero sounds great. Except, wait a minute, this says subject to uniform minimum fees. Remember, the objective is the patent holder wants to make money. So what are these uniform minimum fees? NIST did not say in the announcement, and there was nothing publicly from PKP. So I got on the phone and called PKP, and maybe I was recording the phone call, and I said, I'm interested in the digital signature algorithm, and maybe I can put it into some software. And I've heard that you're licensing this, and I'd like to know what your charges are for that. And Public Key Partners said, well, yeah, there's this 5% plus the following uniform minimum fees. If you're a small company, it's $10,000. If you're a large company, it's $25,000. Plus, for every program every year using DSA, it's $10,000. Plus, if you have a program with more than 2,000 users, then it's $5 per user. I don't remember if that was also per year. But okay, this was the uniform minimum fees. I'm not sure what they mean by uniform here. If these amounts of money do not sound like a lot of money, remember inflation. In all seriousness, these amounts are pretty typical for patent companies that are trying to make money because, well, they're not sure how much value the patents are, how much you're willing to pay for something. And if they try asking for too much, then companies will say, companies that are thinking about this will say, you know, we could actually take them to court and maybe kill the patent. And that only costs a few a few hundred thousand dollars. So if the fees are going to be more than a few a few hundred thousand dollars, then might as well go to court. So companies with patents, they keep the prices below that normally, unless they're very, very confident in their patents being valid. In any case, this amount of money obviously does not allow, for example, all sorts of free web browsers to be using signatures and or whatever applications that you want using signatures. This amount of money is too much for everybody to be using DSA. The 5% would have been okay. These minimum fees were not. And then, well, I distributed a form letter, so something anybody could copy, which was something to send to NIST, which was asking for a free license for DSA from NIST. And I was mentioning the other day, this is something which, by law, NIST is required to take license requests as objections to giving away a patent to a private company. And I also distributed a letter which was saying more objections to the transfer. And, well, in 1994, they said, okay, look, here's the standard, and we're not transferring it, you're not doing anything. What the standard says is the Department of Commerce is not aware of any patents that would be infringed by this standard. So you can use this patent, you can use this standard without worrying about any patents, which is a very interesting claim to make after NSA has a patent on it. Well, okay, they were giving that away for free. PKP was claiming the Schnorr patent applies to it. But, well, okay, NIST was just saying, not our problem, have fun. Some more patents, and then I should stop. Actually, maybe I should check. I still do have a bit of time. So just a few more examples of maybe more typical patents. I mean, I've been talking about some big patents on things that are like, here's crypto systems that are famous crypto systems and people had patents on those crypto systems or maybe covering those crypto systems and clearly trying to make as much money as they could with those monopolies. Well, these Next examples, this is smaller examples where it's not like an entire crypto system, but people will apply for patents on all sorts of little ideas, and then you come along and just accidentally do the same thing. You're not even sometimes even realizing that somebody had a paper on this or a patent on this because it's so easy to do. And then you just do it, and then the patent holder says, I have a patent on that, and you're not allowed to do this. So, I mean, obvious things. This paper on this slide is from Bender and Castagnoli at Crypto 89. And the point of the paper was implementing Diffie-Hellman using different elliptic curves and seeing what kind of performance they could get. And they had some examples. For example, one elliptic curve mod 2 to the 127 plus a small number. And they commented, this is convenient in computer arithmetic. And anybody writing software for these things says, yeah, it's convenient to have a prime close to a power of 2 instead of a prime with many more, a prime that's many more digits to write down is more complicated to do the arithmetic and slower. Now, they did not apply for a patent. Richard Crandall, in 1991, filed patent applications on elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman modulo P, where mod P arithmetic is performed in a processor using only shift and add operations. And then, as more specific claims, he said, do that for 2 to the q minus a number that fits in 32 bits. For example, 2 to the q minus 1 or 2 to the q plus 1, so you could be negative. And, well, I mean, this is including what was already published 2 years earlier. But he didn't cite that. And he received 3 U.S. patents on this. Another example, Yao and Pippinger. They, in 1976, had some nice optimizations of exponentiation. If you're doing exponentiation with multiple bases and providing multiple outputs, maybe that, like computing g to the a times h to the p, h to the b, and g to the c times h to the d, modulo some prime, or in general, they were looking at the general exponentiation situation. There were a few improvements. Pippinger was improving on Yao, and Knuth found some different improvements on Yao's algorithm, published those in 81 as part of his books on the art of computer programming. Then Brickell, Gordon, McCurley, and Wilson at Eurocrypt 92 said, we have some new algorithms for exponentiation, not citing Yao or Pippinger or Knuth, and the algorithms are not new. But, well, that did not stop them from getting a paper at Eurocrypt because people were not checking the literature. And in the 1990s, it was not as easy to find the literature. And then Brickell, Gordon, and McCurley applied for and received a patent. I guess Wilson was just helping write the paper, and Brickell, Gordon, and McCurley said they are the inventors. So this is something which clearly was published earlier without people trying to patent it, and then people came along and patented it. And then Lim and Lee looked at the Eurocrypt paper and said, we can do better than that. This is a general problem in science. If people are ignoring the literature and then do something which is, well, much worse or part of what was done before, but not the full generality, not the full power of what was done in 1976. If people have something worse that is published in 1992 at a big conference, then other people assume that that is the best thing that's known. And so Lim and Lee said, oh, we can do some improvements on that. And, well, I mean, they are improvements compared to 1992, but they're still only part of what was done in 1976. And they got a patent on the improvement. They said to the patent office, we have something better than this 92 patent. And the patent office says, okay, great, you can have a patent. But all of this was actually published in 1976. Another example, elliptic curve point compression. There's a 92 paper from Harper, Menezes, and Vanstone that says, if you have an elliptic curve point, it has X and Y. And if those are each n bits, then, well, compression is going to say you only need one bit of y, because y satisfies a quadratic equation. And there's various ways to decide which bit you use for that. And so this paper, which was on all sorts of other things, it said you can reduce the key length for elliptic curve keys from 2n bits to n plus 1 bit. Actually, already in the 1986 paper, Crypto 85, from Victor Miller on doing elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, he said how you could use just n bits. But, okay, in this Eurocrypt 92 paper, Harper, Menezes, and Vanstone said, here's, along with various other things, they said, here's how you can do n plus 1 bits for your key. And then Vanstone and Mullen and Agnew filed a patent application on elliptic curve point compression in July 94, which is 2 years after Eurocrypt 92, and they got a patent on that. Now, how was Vanstone ignoring the previous paper by Harper, Menezes, and Vanstone? Well, you actually get in trouble in the U.S. Patent Office if you are hiding things and they can prove that you're hiding things. So what you do when you're providing a patent application is you list a bibliography without saying this bibliography includes what we're trying to patent. In this case, the 1994 patent application, the patent says, here's in the bibliography a reference to a thesis by Alfred Menezes, 93 pages in 1992, on elliptic curve cryptosystems, which sounds like general background. Now, would a patent examiner look at the thesis and see, oh, chapter something is this Eurocrypt 92 paper, which is saying what the patent is about, point compression? Very unlikely. And, well, I mean, the patent office, they don't really have motivation to do that. The patent office, they want to make money on granting patents. They want to not get in trouble by granting really, really embarrassing patents. So they have to do something to look like they're following the rules, but basically they want to make money. So they're not going to ask the University of Waterloo Library for a copy of a 93-page thesis just in case it has something which is showing that the patent applicants are lying to the patent office. This patent on elliptic curve point compression is just one example of Certicom's patents, which they varied in whether they were patents on things that were already known or things already known from other people. In any case, most of Certicom's patents were on very obscure things. But when they sent threatening letters to people, they said, we have patents on point compression, public key validation, key establishment. That sounds very general. Digital signature schemes, speeding up finite field operations, speeding up modular integer arithmetic. It sounds like they have patents on everything. And then just in case people thought they were not serious, they sued Sony in 2007. And, well, we don't know how much Sony ended up paying in 2009. We know that the case was settled between Certicom and Sony. So people were really scared for many years to deploy elliptic curve cryptography, even though state-of-the-art elliptic curve cryptography could do what Victor Miller said in 1986, using formulas from Montgomery in 1987, and just skip all of this Certicom stuff, and none of their speed-ups in anything were things you need to use for state-of-the-art elliptic curves, because there were other older speed-ups that were faster, better than what Certicom was providing. But this is not obvious. If Certicom says we have many, many patents and we insist that you pay us, then, well, some companies said, okay, we can maybe deploy a little bit of ECC, but most companies were taking until around 2013 to say, all right, it's safe to deploy ECC. I have two more slides. One of them is just about the thought process of the people today applying for patents. Again, they want money. That's the basic motivation, which, I mean, maybe it's the employer, the company saying, you have to give your patents to your employer, and the employer will make money and give a bonus, give some part of the money to the employee. Sometimes people say patents will give us more credit. And credit, of course, is an indirect way of making money, but it sounds less greedy to talk about credit. In any case, whatever the motivation is, people say, why not? If they, it's just a little bit of work to apply for a patent, and if the employer is paying, or if somebody else pays the patent application fee, okay, if you have some really stupid idea, then maybe you don't bother. But if somebody has an idea where they think, I could make lots of money from this, then why not? Now, when people are thinking this way, they view the scientific process differently. So they look at scientific papers and say, I wonder if I could patent what's in this paper. Could I get away with that? Here's something that I published or somebody else published. It doesn't matter. Can I patent this thing? And then, well, try filing a patent. And we've seen lots of ways that you can end up with a patent on something that was already published. You could also look at the paper reviewing process, conferences, journals. You can volunteer to review papers as an expert on whatever topic. And then you look at the papers saying, is there something in this submission which I can patent? You can collaborate with people. You can say, I noticed you have an interesting idea. I'd be interested in collaborating. I can help you as follows. And what you're actually thinking is there something here that I can patent? And then, well, sometimes people do go ahead and patent ideas where it's, again, clear in one example after another, all of these things would have been published and in most cases were published without the incentive of patents. All right, last slide is just observing something that journals and conferences can do to stop people from stealing ideas from papers under submission and patenting those. Journals and conferences could say, reviewers, if you want to review papers, you have to sign the following. In exchange for being allowed to participate in this, I will not apply for any patents for the next 5 years. Also, I have not applied for any patents in the previous 5 years. And if I've applied for some number of patents before, then 5 years gets replaced by five plus that number of patents years. So the point of these timelines is to discourage people from applying for patents and to make sure that if they do come along with no patents or waiting long enough and volunteer to review, then they will definitely not apply for patents on whatever they steal from the reviewing process. And also, when we have collaborations with people, then we can say, hey, you have to sign this to collaborate. And this is something where I've actually sometimes said to people, I mean, people come to me and say, hey, let's work on this, work on that. And most of the time I'm happy to. But sometimes I've said, no, you are a monopolist and you are really damaging cryptography. I'm not willing to collaborate with you. But if I just say that privately, then it's not really discouraging patent applications. If this is something that journals and conferences and more people start doing publicly, then it might actually make a difference in people's incentives. They will actually have a reason to say, why not apply for patents? All right, so that was all my slides, and then I'm happy to take any questions.